The views expressed in this interview are those of the individuals and do not reflect the official policy or position of the U.S. government, the Department of Defense, the U.S. Navy, or the Naval Postgraduate School. Welcome to the Trident Room, brewer of stout conversation, unfiltered and on tap.
Part one of a two-part series.
Welcome back to the Trident Room podcast. Your hosts today are Lieutenant Commander Colleen Wilmington and Lieutenant Tony Castillo. Today we have the distinct honor to learn from Admiral Cecil Haney, retired United States Navy, who is on campus to inspire our winter 2025 graduates at commencement tomorrow. Admiral Haney is the former commander of U.S. Strategic Command and U.S. Pacific Fleet. And if you didn't know about his history, here it is. Admiral Haney retired from the U.S. Navy in 2017 after 38 years of distinguished service. He began his career in 1974 at the Naval Academy and upon graduation with a degree in ocean engineering, became a submarine officer. He completed operational assignments on USS John C. Calhoun, USS Frank Cable, USS Hyman G. Rickover, USS Asheville, and Submarine Squadron 8, ultimately commanding the fast-attack nuclear submarine USS Honolulu, Submarine Squadron 1, and Submarine Group 2. Admiral Haney also served on the staff of the Chief of Naval Operations as the Director of Submarine Warfare and the Director of the Naval Warfare Integration Group. He rose to the rank of four-star admiral as commander of the U.S. Pacific Fleet in 2012, and then to his culminating assignment as Commander United States Strategic Command in 2013, where he was responsible for all U.S. nuclear weapons, missile defense, space, and cyberspace. He serves on various academic, industry, and nonprofit boards, including Johns Hopkins Applied Physics, Penn State Applied Research Lab, the USNA and Naval Postgraduate School Foundations, the Aerospace Corporation, General Dynamics, Tenet Healthcare, Systems Planning and Analysis Incorporated, the Center for a New American Security, and as chairman of the board for the Military Child Education Coalition and the Hillendale Baptist Church. Admiral Haney earned his own master degree from the Naval Postgraduate School in 1987 with distinction. He was the first African-American NPS graduate to achieve the rank of four-star admiral and is an inductee to the NPS Hall of Fame. Welcome, sir.
Looking back over your career, was there a particular moment or experience that fundamentally shaped your approach to leadership and strategy?
Yes, there was, as a matter of fact, and it's probably not as profound as you would think, but it happened very early in my Navy uniform days. I was on the submarine John C. Calhoun, and I had started off with being the electrical division officer, and then I moved to be the main propulsion assistant. And my first LPO was a master chief, and he was God's gift to the planet. I got to see what good really looked like, and I got it sort of spoiled. My next division that I was assigned to, that was a much younger chief petty officer. And for a while, we were not clicking very well. And I very seldom brought work home to my bride, but I ended up sharing some frustration. I didn't understand why I wasn't clicking well, et cetera. And she asked me, being the sociology kind of major background she was, she asked me a fundamental question that really changed my outlook on dealing with people. And she said, is something else going on in his life that might be causing him to not perform as well as you expect? And, you know, I was deadpan and embarrassed a bit to say that, no, I didn't know that. I guess, you know, I've gone to the Naval Academy, I've learned about leadership, rah, 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 this and that. But that business of what's going on in people's lives dictates their performance. I went back, talked to him about it, and sure enough, there was something. I needed to give him some time off so that he could get something on the family side squared away. He did, and we became, you know, two peas in a pod and working together from that point on. But that basic question of what's going on in other people's lives is something that has stuck with me for how I deal with people going forward as a leader, to make sure we are on all cylinders when we need to be and not to make that assumption going forward. So I was blessed by that.
I think that empathetic leadership has become a significant turn of many of our leaders in recent years, and looking to make sure that we are taking care of the person behind the billet.
The person and the family behind the billet in many ways.
Do you think it's something that's solely in the military now that you have experience both inside and outside of it? Or do you think that some of the perhaps civilian sectors still kind of learning some of that aspect, having a holistic view to the team, vice a more partitioned view of every individual's contribution to the team?
Well, in the commercial and civilian world, it depends. It depends on the outfit and the leadership associated with the outfit. So if I went through my scattergram, I'm all different. But the one thing I will say that's truly challenging for some, if you have an entity that is dispersed, and particularly during COVID where people couldn't meet and that kind of thing, that they have to work virtually because you can't bring everybody into one place as often as you want to. That's where the challenge I saw and would sort of coach the leadership team of, you know, you really need to somehow have a mechanism that when you are close to that person's location, pull that leader in and talk about that ahead of time. And that's a valuable conversation you may not get over the virtual conversation through our various Zoom, et cetera, apps.
So prevent the silo, not just information, but also of the organization in itself.
And that spreads to how you ensure the culture of the organization you want as a leader is perpetuated in a good way.
Has this evolved over time, do you think, sir? Not just in the military, your time, but also your experience also, and well, since you've been out, just different leadership mindsets?
Oh, absolutely. I think we've come a long way. You know, I can remember early on in our computer days having a leader that had a statement, I won't get it exactly right, but it was sort of like, real leaders don't need computers. And it's interesting how far we have gone in that business going forward. And it was, you know, the time frame they were issuing laptops and those kind of things, you know, in that regard, to even working in the Pentagon for some civilians, so civil servants, as those personnel digital assistants came out. And I was begging for one, and they didn't understand why I needed it. So I ended up getting one, and getting it those days to get the IT people to connect it to my computer. Today, you couldn't do that without permission. And I watched them get them issued to them and just grow dusk. And then as I started showing them the flexibility that I had with it, it was interesting seeing they could appreciate this new way of being able to store data, retrieve data, Google data, and that kind of thing, and how valuable that was going forward.
I think each generation has their own version of like a Luddite, you know, an obstinance towards some sort of technology acceptance. And I'm sure we have something similar now with artificial intelligence. Yeah, it's a buzzword, I think, and we've had, you know, this really since in the 50s. But in regards to where you have been, sir, where do you think that plays in regards to not just leadership, perhaps, or technology acceptance, but maybe within future warfare? Where does the artificial intelligence angle fit?
Well, I think, quite frankly, artificial intelligence, the knowledge of it, at least at a 101 level, I call it, every naval officer, every officer in the military should have some core understanding of it. Because to me, it's just like when I came here in mid-80s, you know, we were golden if we had 24 baud modems in terms of just how far we've come. But that and the portable computer was just ramping out, and I had the blessing of being able to think deeply about it, join a computer club and those kind of things here, which helped me truly appreciate ones and zeros at a more intricate level. Well, actually, as high school, I started off punching cards. I was working actually in Washington, D.C. It was called a math aide, but I was a glorified key punch operator. Thankfully, though, my bosses encouraged me to learn COBOL and Fortran as part of that. And it gave me a bit of a leg up when I started college. But so, yeah, I have some of that hard experience. Don't drop the box.
Exactly, yeah. Now, COBOL is still being used, actually, in a lot of different organizations. I mean, I think the Treasury Department still uses it. And yeah, isn't that amazing? Yeah,
it's meteorology uses Fortran.
I was about to say, I have heard of a few folks using Fortran, and I was surprised by that.
Hopper's legacy, I guess they're right.
Over the years between military and civilian, you've experienced a very wide range of leadership styles. What have you noticed about the qualities and skills that separate truly exceptional leaders from those who are merely effective?
Well, I think leaders who lead by example are much more effective leaders than do as I say, not as I do type leaders. And very important leaders that communicate well with those above them, as well as those below them, is another key attribute that's important, because it's how well we communicate and get the information we need. To be a good leader, you have to have the right information at the right time for the right decisions. And if people are afraid to confront you over, boy, Captain, have you thought about this kind of approach? We haven't even talked about this. Or they bring up those kinds of questions and they trigger more information than you would have had as you're making a decision, you know, in a timely way. So that business of promoting not just collaboration, but the person that's at the lowest end on up, all contributing to the cause and giving them recognition and credit for that, I think is very important in today's leadership, because the world's complicated. And even our weapon systems and what have you that we use are very complicated. And you need to have that. And you need to train so that people can give you what you need in a succinct manner, so that, as I say, you can move forward with the right information, the right time for the right decision.
In preparation for the podcast today, I looked up some speeches that you've had. And in the 2016 Deterrence Symposium, you mentioned Joshua Ramos' book, The Seventh Sense. I'm only about a quarter of the way through it, but I picked it up because of that. But it mentions the need to master the speed of information and strategic narrative, which is daily life for most of our fleet, especially as information warfare officers. That's constantly prevalent. So with the two-way communication that you just mentioned and embodying the leadership, how would you prioritize the skills outlined in the book for a young officer today who's preparing for the conflicts of tomorrow?
You know, the business of information flow is so critically important. And how do you get that coupled with how are you a continual learner? The combination is huge, because you can't rest on what you learned 3 years ago, because the world and the capabilities and things change. So you've always got to be a growing military person in that regard, and definitely as a leader. You have to do your own SWOT, as we call it, analysis of what are your strengths versus weaknesses in terms of things, so that you're not just puffed up over your strengths and what might have made you successful over time, but you're also evaluating what am I weak at and what do I need to compensate for that. That particular weakness may require me to have other people that have that skill set nearby me to help make sure they're covering that weakness. That particular weakness may require me to study more in a particular area and grow more in that area and not just assume I know X, Y, or Z. You know, today we talk a lot about artificial intelligence. So I would say, as a leader, if you're not thirsty to understand that and how it may apply better to your organization, you probably are short-sheeting your future capabilities in order to address operational matters, warfighting matters, and ultimately people matters in terms of how you galvanize the team to move forward in an efficient and effective manner. So I'm not sure that's one of the seven and how it's fully captured now, but I think that may have integrated one or two of his seven particular items.
The sea of information that's available now, like how do you build a team or mentors or somebody to help you course correct to find the right path? Because there's a lot of doors to take, a lot of avenues to take in the ocean of information. Like, what are your recommendations to anybody that's trying to navigate this continual learning path, especially with all the information that's available nowadays?
Well, I think you have to have a strategy. You have to have a strategy of what information is important to you today in order to carry out your responsibilities And then how do I get that feed? And what's my battle rhythm of getting that feed periodically? And being very judicious in where is my source of information coming from? Because they're good sources and they're not so good sources. And then sometimes understanding the limitations of those. For, you know, for example, you may get the intelligent feed or someone giving you the daily intelligence brief that tells you, this is what we know and this is what we see, et cetera, about XYZ. The follow-on question as I became a more mature leader was, okay, I got that, but what don't we know? Because I need to understand what we don't know so that I can understand what confidence level of the intelligence that I'm receiving in order to apply it to whatever operations I'm associated with or whatever responsibilities I am to have to deal with. So that piece is important. Reading about the ecosystem sometimes in terms of how decisions are made relative to things that you may be very excited about. But if you don't understand the stakeholder position, you may go into a meeting thinking you're going to carry the day associated with getting this all approved. And you may get a lot of deadpan looks and negative votes to where it isn't. And that requires a lot of times peddling 1v1 to individuals and organizations so that you can get their input earlier on in terms of why do they find that particular approach or plan not to their liking, or they don't believe it's going to work, so that you can then, you might have to go back and do some more homework. But you've done two things. You've gotten their input. You've told them you value their input as you're working this through. Yes, it takes more time, but quite frankly, through it, generally you have a better plan, a better approach, better product, et cetera, as a result of doing those push-ups.
Like we mentioned earlier in regards to knowing your people and, you know, knowing, like you mentioned, the person's stance or stakeholder or the system thinking involved in that. So they might take a certain position, and maybe because the way they were raised or perhaps were taught, and it, I don't want to say outdated, but the way they were thinking perhaps may be a product of whatever system they were grew up in or through their time. And it's something to consider in regards to that, it sounds.
Very important. And it's very important that as a leader, you look at your organization and in addition to yourself and say, boy, what do I need my organization to also grow and learn? Where I was very impressed early years, I was a brand new 05 working in naval reactors. And they would stop what they were doing once a month, practically, and we would have training. And some folks would say, you know, boy, that would be a waste of time. Aren't you just doing your... But that business, sometimes it would be a carrier commanding officer that would come back and tell us how well the propulsion plant helped the particular platform conduct, get through its mission, and you know, any problems or potential problems noted and what have you. And we all grew from that, in addition to what kind of operations did he do for 6+ months with that particular platform. And that piece of putting the why to an organization of why they're doing push-ups and to ensure that capability is resilient and capable and what have you, sometimes is very important. So that's a good feedback loop to improve performance.
You mentioned earlier that there's a need to do some self-evaluation for our own weaknesses to then determine our confidence, which then we can apply to the confidence of our information. At what point do we have to find a balance between recognizing those weaknesses and overcoming self-doubt? And has there ever been a time when you've questioned your own strategic approach or leadership philosophy or doubted your knowledge for a situation?
I wouldn't say doubt without confidence. I think the one thing you're always trying to run hard to understand is, for a given operation, do you have enough of an understanding of the risk associated? And then with that understanding, how are you compensating for that risk so that your mission will have a higher probability of success? And that's, you know, if you have more of a pity party over self-doubt and that kind of thing, to me, you're wasting your time. To me, it's what are you doing to make sure you and your team are best prepared to go do whatever that operational mission is required in order to have that associated success. I think it's very important to be prepared and to understand your level of preparedness. And at the same time, it can't just be rah, rah, rah. It's got to be, you know, as a team, rah, rah. But we understand, boy, that adversary is capable with this, this, and this. And we have to compensate by doing X, Y, or Z so that we can win the day. Your doubt can rub off to the rest of the team in a way. Now, that doesn't mean as a leader, you are going to be blind to certain things in order to show less self-doubt. It means that you've got to do your homework. You've got to demand the team does its part of the homework so that we're all best prepared in order to go into whether that's the war fight or critical operation or whether that's getting something approved through the Pentagon piece so that it's in the budget for what we need for the future.
You think that submariners, that's something indicative of just being a submariner just because you're under the surface. You have sensors, of course, but there's something that you're missing perhaps, and you have to understand like the risks that are there and maybe some of the limitations of knowledge that may that you just don't have just because you're under the surface. You think that's just part of the culture of that community, or is it something that you just had to learn through your time in?
Well, I think it may be part of the culture, but it is also something through a variety of different tours you get more exposure to watching leaders that are above you talk about risk and get at it planning. So yes, there's some from my community, but there was also some from working jobs, particularly involving operational planners. And some of those, I used to call them Jedi Knight planners, and their schooling that they had had in terms of a very methodological approach to, okay, we've got to do this particular operation, whether it was involving joint forces or from a submarine, we've got to go in close to do this particular operation. What are our associated risks? How are we overcoming it? What are tripwires to know that, boy, something has changed in the environment and we may need to regroup before we continue on? Those kinds of things have been sort of inherently built into me from both from a submariner standpoint to the business of various other positions, you know, of leadership involving joint forces. When I was commander of the Pacific Fleet, I was also the commander of what was called Joint Task Force 519. And with it, we would do some sophisticated planning in that regard. And with that planning, it was, you know, really going through meticulously, if you will, with some of that kind of thinking.
With any of these lessons also learned, maybe some movies about submarines, and if that's the case, what are some of your favorite submarine movies that you enjoy?
That's an interesting question, and particularly in today's piece. You know, there is a documentary that I participated in that most do not know, but my kids sometimes remind me of because they were young, and it was called Steel Boats, Iron Men. And you know, there we were on a USS Hyman G. Rickover. I was the engineer, and it was really a documentary on what fast attack submarines did. And we had a film crew on board for a PBS kind of special for two rounds of it, you know, and that I always look back at. Sometimes I show people that clip. It's a little dated now because our control rooms don't look like that. Thankfully, we have more modernistic flat screens and everything else. But that was one. I'm trying to think of the other movie that Denzel Washington was in, and I can't think of its name right now. I'm drawing a blank. But sometimes, you know, it would be interesting in using something like that. But now it's so old of a movie that, you know, most younger folks don't know it in that regard.
Crimson Tide.
Crimson Tide. Yes, yes. And even the doggy in the movie.
Gene Hackman,
yes, yes. There have been a variety of them, but I always warn people, be careful of things Hollywood show you. Some of it has some realism. Some of it has other things that aren't exactly right in them. But I have always thought having some of that Hollywood gets the word out to what submarines do in a way and potential capability and what have you.
Is there a certain aspect of that that you think is commonly overlooked or misunderstood about undersea warfare?
Well, in that one, Gene Hackman and all. I think they had, that was the one that had Jonesy as a sonar guy. And he had his feet propped up, you know, and the captain would come in and say, Jonesy, you know, what's going on out there acoustically in the water? And all I could think of was at the time frame, and even to this day, we have multiple sonarmen that are with very sophisticated screens and listening devices, et cetera, sorting through what's biologically made, what's man-made out there, and what have you. And it's not not someone with their feet propped up, just giving the captain the most crisp answer you'd ever want to hear in that regard.
Another good movie that was a movie that we actually required to watch for one of my networking classes was Greyhound with Tom Hanks. And it's about the convoy system they had in, I believe, World War One, and the convoy system in itself trying to prevent the convoys from being sunk by the German U-boats at the time. And it's a good movie in that respect to kind of give a lot of different sides. And also understands the leader on a warship, what it takes sometimes. And for Tom Hanks in that movie, he's very positive, even if he's going through quite a bit. And there's certain points in the movie where he just can't get that cup of coffee that he really needs. And it's a wonderful movie if you haven't seen it yet, sir. And highly recommend, a good watch.
And the other thing movies like that portray is sometimes we think the ocean is translucent and anti-submarine warfare is easy. And throughout my career, it has not been. And it wasn't then, as those convoy ship guards that were patrolling to try to defend off the wolf packs and what have you. It's hard, dangerous, tedious, and required a lot of skill. Submarine had the upper hand in a lot of cases in that regard. They didn't have the weapons in some cases because they had to get very, very close to do the sinking. But at the same token, a lot of surface warfare ships didn't have the sensors and capabilities that we have today.
Ocean's a big place. I think I read somewhere that we know more about, I think, the moon and outer space than we do in our oceans. And
we're working on it.
Besides that aspect, maybe perhaps public perception that it's easy to find a submarine, or perhaps that the waters are clear, as you mentioned before, is there another perhaps overlooked or misunderstood aspect of undersea warfare?
Well, I think the other one is sometimes not understood is just how versatile our submarines are today. Their ability to go in water that's shallower than the length of the submarine, for example, and spend incredible times in those waters with the sensors we have and the capabilities of the crew, to going in under the ice, just showing the versatility of that piece, to where submarines can be anywhere, sight unseen, able to do their missions in that regard. Sometimes we've gone through periods where, they're just the escort for the carrier strike group or what have you, much more than that in terms of what we have. The fast attack submarines doing the strategic deterrent arsenal of the SSBNs, ballistic missile submarines to those SSGNs that carry sometimes lots of SEALs and many times lots of Tomahawk missiles.
Thanks for joining us in the Trident Room. For more information about today's guests and topics, please visit the show notes online at nps.edu/Trident Room Podcast. The Trident Room podcast has been brought to you by the Naval Postgraduate School Alumni Association and Foundation. For questions, comments, and suggestions, please email us at Trident Room Podcast Host at nps.edu.